let's start with what Russians are doing in Kharkov. We've seen a lot of weapons. They're moving a lot of weapons to the border of Sumy region in the north of Kharkov. And do you know what they're doing, Russian are doing in that region, and what's the plan on their part? Are they gonna capture the city, the region, or they just making a buffer zone there?
Well, they have lots of options. And in fact, what we're seeing is classic, the Soviets mastered this. It's called maskirovka, deception, disguise. So, the Russians are moving troops around. They're moving vehicles. They're giving every indication. They're concentrating some troops up north of Sumy in Belarus. So if you're the Ukrainians, you say, oh, my God, well, we got to go there and be prepared to try to counter a Russian attack if it comes. So they've got to move and deploy forces. Well, if Ukraine was sitting on a surplus of personnel, that might not be such an important move by the Russians, but it's just the opposite. The Ukrainians don't have a lot of troops. They've got so they have to use them sparingly. They can't deploy them everywhere at once. They have to move them to certain locations. So if they move troops up to that Sumy region to be prepared to deal with the Russians, they've had to take troops from another spot, which means they've created a weakness in their line. And, I've likened this to a boxing match, only instead of, you're sitting there with your two fists up, the Russians have eight fists. Think of it as like, like the Hindu god, vision. We got all the arms and legs. We got multiple areas that they can punch, and they can punch at all the same time now. So they're down south around Zaporizhia. They're at several spots along the line from, Bakhmut, Avdiivka, Rabatino. And so all along this line, the Russians push forward. They're creating breakthroughs. They're forcing the Ukrainians to react to try to stop those breakthroughs. And then they get this, add up this new pressure. So what's taking place now that we didn't see a year ago is that the Russians are moving forward very, deliberately, forcefully, all along that front, and forcing the Ukrainians to make choices. And in making those choices to strengthen one area, they're going to weaken another. For example, they didn't have a huge troop concentration around Kharkiv. And I do not think the Russians at this point are going to take Kharkiv in terms of attack it as a city, fight their way through the streets like they did with Mariupol in May of 2022. Instead, what they're going to do is probably encircle the city, cut off rail lines and roadways so that they can't be resupplied, starve them out, force them to surrender that way. So it is, we've entered a new phase of the war. The Russian general staff's not necessarily calling it an offensive, but it's an offensive, but it's just not the classical big, 1,000 tanks lined up and then roaring across the steppes of Ukraine to take territory. Their goal remains, number one, they've got to destroy these Ukrainian units that are facing them. And they're going to do that first with artillery and with glide bombs and then with drones and then tanks and then people. They're not going to go people first and then all the other. They're husbanding their personnel resources in Russia.
Yeah. Do you think the strategy would be just overstretch the Ukrainian army? We know that the manpower in the Ukrainian army is so weak right now in his yeah. weakest point so far. And they're trying to overstretch this army, and just it would be much more easier to get Nikolaev, Odessa, these cities.
Yeah, well, you've got kids, and if you've had birthday parties, you've had to blow up balloons, right? So you get a balloon and you blow it up and blow it up, and you keep blowing and blowing and blowing and blowing, and then boom, it explodes because you've stretched it too thin. That's exactly what's happening to Ukraine. It's the balloon model, let's call it that. They're going to get overstretched. The pressure is going to be so great. that it's going to cause a breakup and a collapse. It's going to, you know, it's slowly, 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 and then all at once, boom. But it will collapse. That's where they're headed.
Yeah, it would be one of the reasons that Victoria Nuland on ABC News said we have to facilitate Ukrainian army to attack Russian to attack targets inside Russia. And we have this concept was repeated by Antony Blinken, and just helping Ukrainian to attack Russia. Do you think, are they trying to distract Russia from what they're doing right now in Ukraine?
Well, I don't know what their thought process is. The consequence of it is this. They're pissing off the Russians. They're not calming the Russians down. They're not building goodwill with the Russians. They're not putting so much pressure on Russia that the Russians are going, oh, make it stop, please. We give up. No, it's just the opposite. The Russians are getting madder about it, but not mad with an emotional rage where they're just throwing wild punches. Well, it's that different kind of anger where, okay, we're going to finish you, and I'm going to finish you now. And all of a sudden, it's completely changed the calculus. There was a point early on in this when Russia was willing to even still allow the Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk, to stay in Ukraine, as long as they had a guarantee that the rights of those people in Luhansk and Donetsk would be respected and they wouldn't be punished for speaking Russian. But as we learned, that it was a complete sham by the West. Germany and France had no intention of enforcing that. They lied about it. So at that point, Russia realized, can't trust the West. So now, you know, they're in it to the bitter end. And these attacks inside, you know, they've been attacking, the Ukrainians have been attacking for the last 12 years in both in Donetsk and some across border, but they're not hitting any critical military infrastructure. And frankly, they don't have the capability to hit the kind of military assets that would weaken Russia to the point that Russia would not be able to operate militarily. The Russian military is simply just too damn big. And Ukraine doesn't have the manpower, much less the weaponry. Let's say the United States gave them every HIMARS in its inventory. It's not going to make a difference. If they gave them every attack of missiles, it's not going to make a difference. It may cause some more human casualties, civilian casualties, I mean, but it's not going to change the strategic picture on the ground, which is Ukraine does not have the manpower, the trained manpower to fight the current battle. It doesn't have the ability to recruit and train a replacement army in time to prevent the Russians from conquering Ukraine. You know, I hear some people still talk about this can be a, you know, this could go on through 2025, 2026. You know, that's nonsense. You know, I'd be willing to wager a heavy amount of money on that. Because what we're seeing is the disintegration of the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian military itself, at the same time that we're seeing the Russians grow stronger, not weaker.
Did you see Boris Johnson invited a number of Azov battalion, and he was talking with them. He was suggesting that we have to give them attackums. We have to give them anything they need to attack Russia. And it was so amazing because in that picture, you see Ben Wallace just behind Boris Johnson. And he's a military man, it seems. Azov battalion. And calling them a hero. He was calling them, you are heroes of Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah, no, these guys are just without any kind of honor. You know, I was fortunate growing up 30 years ago to be mentored by a retired Marine colonel and a retired Army colonel. Both had fought in Vietnam, which didn't turn out too well for the West. but both had experienced combat. Not necessarily the kind of combat that the Ukrainians are experiencing with the Russians in terms of peer-to-peer modern warfare, but it's still people were getting killed and blown up. And so they understood sort of the blood cost of it. And so what they inculcated in me is an appreciation for the actual nuts and bolts of, if you're asking somebody to put on a uniform and carry a weapon and then to carry out combat operations, well, you have to understand that there's a lot of backloaded information and training that undergirds that, if it's going to be carried out with any potential for success. And I know for myself, as I'm a firearms trainer, I train people with rifle and pistol. And so I know what the challenges are in training people to adopt, have the ability to shoot accurately and to shoot under stressful conditions. It's not easy. And so when you factor all that in, then you listen to a clown like Boris Johnson. Frank, thank God, no relation to me. That talks so casually and carelessly about placing attack missiles that they're going to fire off like there's some magic solution. And I just wrote a piece, my latest piece at sonar21.com, where I drew the analogy of a punch. If all you're saying is, hey, if we just use violence, it's going to succeed. Well, okay, punching someone or something is violent. If I go over here and punch the wall, as long as it's not concrete, I might put a dent into it, but I still may break the bones in my hand. Now, that's violent, but didn't accomplish anything. I could go out, be walking down the street, and just take a random passerby and cold cock him, punch him with a sucker punch. Now, that would be a criminal act. And again, the only thing it's going to probably accomplish is get my ass arrested and facing a civil lawsuit. So again, why do it? It's violent, but what does it achieve? Or if I get into the boxing ring with, say, Mike Tyson or Muhammad Ali, if he was still alive, the only way I might have a chance against Muhammad Ali is if he was still alive at 80 years old and had Parkinson's disease. Okay, I might stand a chance then. But the point is, at that point, you're using your fists to defend, and you can deliver a blow. And that blow is designed to hurt the opponent, to weaken them so they can't fight. So what is it that Ukraine's trying to do with these attack of missiles? Frankly, they're doing the equivalent of just punching a wall with their own hand. Because every missile they fire off against a target that they can't really destroy, there are no more attack of missiles behind that. The United States is not like making them. You know, it's not like a pancake breakfast where, you know, there are crowds out there eating pancakes and, man, you're back there making them and eating them and making them. And no. You got a stack of pancakes. There's no more batter. You eat it, it's gone. You use it, it's gone. Same with the Patriots, same with the Attackums, same with the HIMARS. And so here's Ukraine. You know, the other day they fired off, I think, four Attackums maybe, and they blew up two MiG-31s in the peninsula there, and in Crimea, I think it was around Sevastopol. Oh boy, that was a major blow against Russia. Except then it turned out those planes had been parked there for like 2 years because they're no longer airworthy. They'd be cannibalizing them for parts. And they probably were put there as just bait. So, hey, yeah, let Ukraine fire its attack of missiles there. Blow up those airplanes. That's two, three, four less attack of missiles they had when they started out. And there's no way to replace them. Guess what? Russia's figured out a way to attrit the offensive capability of Ukraine. So, I mean, you need to. So people like Johnson and others, when they're talking about this, they don't even know how to think this way. It's too complex. You know, they just, they're juveniles, really. It's just a level of immaturity that is embarrassing.
Yeah, we've learned that France is training the Ukrainian army, do you think that after 2 years of this war in Ukraine, who is much more experienced for in this war? Is Ukraine? Is it going to be Ukrainians or French? And
what are the French training them to do? Okay, monsieur, here is how you hold up the white flag, la bandera blanca. And say, rendir, me rindi. You know, I surrender. You know, is that what the French are teaching them? I mean, that's what the French have been good at. Hey, dien bien phu, we surrender, you know, to the Vietnamese. Germans in Dunkirk, we surrender. You know, the United States and Brits, if it wasn't for them, you know, the French would still be speaking Deutschland. They'd be singing Deutschland über alles, as opposed to, you know, their bloodthirsty national anthem. If you ever looked at the words of that, that's off topic. But no, yeah, what did the French have to teach them? The French have no experience in modern combined arms warfare. They may be able to teach them how to, you know, the proper way to drink cognac. They may be able to teach them how to, hey, our MREs are, you know, our, you know, meals that we get, they're really good. They're not like the crappy American meals. You even got Galois cigarettes in them, each pack. Oh, you know, smoke up. It's ridiculous. So, you know, but it's the arrogance of NATO. Oh, yeah. We're going to come train you. Okay. And what are you going to teach us? Apart from your expertise as established on the battlefield as surrender monkeys, what else do you have to offer, French?
If the level of training in NATO countries is the same as we've seen in Ukraine, that would be a disaster if they go to war and need direct confrontation with Russia.
Yeah. Hey, United States. Yeah, we're here to train you now. Let's show you how we did it in Afghanistan. And if I was a smart ass Ukrainian troop, I'd say, yeah, tell me about that August 2021. What was that what you called an offense as you were rapidly trying to escape out of an airport and you got 13 of your Marines blown up and people were falling off of airplanes, clinging to them, trying to get the hell out, and you failed to hold back the Taliban? Is that what you're teaching us to do? Yeah, so you're teaching us to prepare for surrender to the Russians. Maybe that's what you're good at. I mean, you know, what great victory in terms of combat skills have the United States established over the last 20 years? Zero. And I know, you know, I'm not trying to piss off my buddies who served. You know, God bless them for serving. But stop bullshitting yourselves that we did so. Oh, man. Boy, we kicked ass against those Afghans. Yeah, we took on a bunch of goat herders and sheep herders and still couldn't beat them. And they come out, oh, we didn't beat them because we didn't put in everything we had. Oh, shut up. We used the same damn excuse in Vietnam. Well, you know what? Right now, we got 452,000 guys in the U.S. Army active duty. Let's put all of them into Ukraine. And you know what? Russia's got 1.3 million, almost triple the number. They'll kick our ass. So stop it with this Uncle Sam, the Superman bullshit. I am fed up with it. Sorry. That's my rant for the day.
We know that Zelensky's term has come to an end, and he's continuing under the martial law right now.
Wait, over? It's not over till we say it's over. That's what I would put. I'd have Jim Belushi from Animal House doing over. It's not over till we say it's over. Now you're correct. It did end Monday night or Tuesday morning at 12:01 a.m. So yeah. Go on. Sorry to interrupt.
And then we know that in Ukraine, ex-president of Ukraine Poroshenko, he's not happy with the situation right now in Ukraine. We know a lot of political parties, if we can call them parties, political movements, yeah, inside Ukraine that are not happy with the situation. How do you see the situation right now, the political situation in Ukraine?
Yeah, like we're back to, you know, another movie reference, Cabaret. Money, 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 money. That's why Poroshenko's upset. Man, he's missing out on the grift, the billion-dollar grift. Man, the United States is sending over these billions of dollars that are ripe for the stealing. I mean, Zelensky's been raking in the cash. And look, you know, the final, I think everybody sort of finally came to the realization, you know, 2 weeks ago when the Russians came across the river. They started surrounding Kharkiv on the flanks. And everybody's going, we spent billions of dollars on dragon's teeth and trench digging equipment and concrete to build underground bunkers, fortified fighting positions. Where is it? Because we got the invoices here saying that we're built. And we're looking around and there's all the dragon's teeth stacked up, you know, alongside the road, haven't been deployed. The trenches, they built like a mile worth of trenches and bam, made it immaculate. It was the ultimate Potemkin village, you know, that on the facade looked great. Boy, this is terrific, man. We do this all on the line. We were going to kick some Russian ass. Then they realized it was just, that was the only propaganda place right there. None of the other stuff existed. So these guys, you know, this is about the money. And Zelensky ain't letting go. He's, you know, he's going to try to hang on as long as possible. I think he's going to get killed in office personally. Because if the Wall Street Journal report is true, the other day he's screaming at generals. I've always made it a rule of thumb. Unless I'm carrying a gun, I don't start screaming at somebody that's carrying a gun, all right? It's just not healthy. You're at an immediate disadvantage. And if he's foolish enough to think that, you know, he can scream at the military and that they're with the guns and the ammunition, you know, they might be inclined to use it against him.
And do you think that that's going toward some sort of military coup in Ukraine?
Yeah. No, I think that's ultimately where it's headed. Because once he declared martial law and suspended, you know, he'd already suspended free press, free elections, opposition political parties. There is no, you know, it's not like you go flip a switch and all the lights come back on, the political processes start operating again. These opposition political parties rise from the dead and, you know, they come back to life. No, he shut that down. So you're going to have to go with who's organized that could still sort of bring order to the country. Well, you've got actually several elements. You got sort of what I'll call the traditional Ukrainian army. You've got the ideological zealots part, which are the Azov Battalion, the Reich Sector, Kraken Brigades. We've got those. Maybe they could try to take over. But then that would also set up a battle between those two factions, because one doesn't necessarily like the other. So, yeah, it's a recipe for pure chaos. It's getting ready to unfold. Because as all of this happens, the economy in Ukraine let's call it on life support. The combination of Russian attacks to destroy power plants, all the thermal power plants, hydroelectric power plants, coal-fired power plants, is you know, preventing industries from being able to operate. And then the threat of getting dragooned and forced into a combat unit is keeping a lot of guys are just hiding out at home. They're not going out. They're avoiding the recruiters. Well, that, you know, that means that the productive work that should be getting done isn't getting done. And with the power outages, you know, you get your smartphones don't get charged, your computers aren't able to work, internet's not available. So it just, you know, this is going to create and deteriorate morale in the country even more.
If Ukrainians are smart enough to see what has happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, they would see that their future is with Russia, not with the United States and Europe. Because
yeah,
it's
already
Russia that didn't destroy the western part of Ukraine, because they don't want a failed state on their border. That's why they didn't destroy their infrastructure in the western part of Ukraine.
Yeah, or at least they were trying to destroy the civilians. The shock and awe campaign that the United States was so proud of in the World War II, our firebombing of cities like Tokyo and Dresden, served no military purpose. It was basically a terror campaign to terrorize citizens, the non-military component, thinking that that would sap support from the government, from Hitler and from Tojo and from the emperor in Japan. But that didn't happen. It's just the opposite effect. People sort of rallied around him. I think the Russians are smart enough. They figured that out. So, they're concentrating on destroying military targets of Ukraine and making it impossible for the Ukrainian military to operate or create more obstacles in that regard.
Yeah. Larry, the other distraction for Russians would be the situation in Georgia. We had this new law on foreign agents. They're talking that was passed by the parliament, later on was vetoed by the president. And the political parties are talking about this and are criticizing president for vetoing the law. And how do you see the situation right now? The United States is just threatening them or putting sanction on Georgia, on these people who are behind this law. And
yeah,
how do you find the current situation in Georgia?
Well, it's a failed color revolution. The West, the United States principally, Britain to a lesser extent, are doing their damnedest to try to defeat this law and defeat those members of the parliament in Georgia who are advocating for this law. Now, it looks like they've got enough votes to override the president's veto. Well, for God's sake, this president of Georgia, I'm as qualified to be the president of Georgia as she is, except she's a French citizen, born in France, raised in France, schooled in France, carried a French passport, served in the French foreign ministry. She's about as French as French fries. And yet, of Georgian heritage, her parents came from Georgia. So lo and behold, they decide at some point they offer her, hey, come and run and we'll let you be president and we'll give you your citizenship. Which, when she became president, she basically gave up her French citizenship to become a Georgian citizen. Well, she's a foreigner as far as the Georgians are concerned. And we, if she tried to run like that in the United States, the Constitution prohibits it. It had to be natural born. So on the one hand, you've got this, subversive agent inside the government trying to drive it into the arms of the European community. But the, Georgian parliament reflects the will of the Georgian people, and the vast majority of the Georgian people say, hell no, we don't want to go that way. Now, there are a lot of people out in the streets protesting because they're getting paid by people like George Soros and National Endowment for Democracy and all these other government agencies, OGA, as they're called. And they don't want to have it be exposed how much outside influence there is in corrupting what the Georgian political process, how it operates. So that, that's, what's going on right now is the United States is trying hard to blow up the Georgian government and the Georgians are refusing to go along. So, and only this time, so what was it, 16 years ago, Russia and Georgia were at war because Georgia invaded Russia. But now I think you're seeing that there are some in the Russian government that are working on the intelligence side closely with their Georgian counterparts to identify and defeat these outsiders who are coming in. I mean, hell, the other day you had the foreign ministers of Estonia, and was it Estonia, Latvia, and Norway or Netherlands, marching with the demonstrators in Georgia calling for the law to be overturned. These are foreigners attending this. I drew the analogy. Could you imagine the Russian ambassador the ambassador from China and the ambassador from, say, Hungary, attending a Donald Trump rally in New York City, calling for the overthrow of a law passed by the U.S. Congress. Can you imagine that? We'd go crazy. I mean, my God, how, you know, who do they think they are? So it's like I said, the hypocrisy on this stinks to high heaven.
Yeah. So amazing how they put these foreign ministers of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia on the street protesting what's going on in.
Yeah. Good God. Go home, you know, go home and protest. Protest in your own damn country. You know, I lived in Guatemala. I've lived in Honduras. I've lived in Argentina. And I visited other countries, spent a lot of time in Germany, some time in Brazil. I'd never, never, ever entered my mind to go out into the street to protest a policy of Mexico or Brazil or Guatemala or Honduras while I'm there as a guest. You know, that's just bad manners for starters. And but yet, you know, we see what a bunch of crude elites we have in Europe, where they, you know, they're so busy turning up their nose at the countries like Georgia, where the people try to defend their rights, that they don't realize that, you know, they're wearing clothes that they threw up on and it smells. You know, they're trying to tell other people how to be clean. Meanwhile, they're a walking biohazard because they haven't washed, you know, the puke and the excrement from their garments.
We know that we're going to have a summit in Switzerland in June on Ukraine. And the Brazilian president said, Lula said he's not going to be there. And the head of South Africa said the same thing. It seems that China is not going to send anybody there. We don't know. We still don't know.
Right.
And right, we learned today that Bloomberg reported that Biden is not going to be there. It's just amazing what they're doing there. Even if it was all about PR, that if Joe Biden is not there, what they're going to do there?
This is like holding an international beauty pageant, except only other ugly girls are going to attend. So, you know, it's not going to really be a beauty pageant. It's going to be an ugly fest. You know, it's going to be Ukraine, talking about Ukraine. You know, as the egotist said, hey, enough about me. Let's talk about me some more. You know, and so that's Ukraine. It's going to be all Ukraine all the time. And with countries that, you know, they may have some money to toss its way. But, you know, the key in a peace plan is either Russia's got to be losing on the battlefield and is looking for an escape route. Well, that's not happening. Russia's facing tremendous political pressure at home to stop the war, bring the boys back. That's not happening. Or Russia's winning the war, defeating Ukraine. And Ukraine's desperately trying to figure out how the hell do I get myself out of this. Again, Russia's not going to go, you know, all we have to talk about at that point is how are you going to surrender? You know, you're going to break ties with the West. No more of this EU nonsense, and especially no more of this NATO nonsense. That's done. That's over.
Yeah. Putin said that he's not going to negotiate with Zelensky because he doesn't recognize Zelensky as the president of Ukraine anymore.
Well, true. I mean, what authority does Zelensky have to sign anything on behalf of Ukraine? He has no authority legally. He can, you know, he can complain. He can state that he's the president of the world. You know, I'm king of the earth. Okay, you can say it. Oh, that's going to ensure some guy's going to come by, put a white coat on you where your arms are tied behind your back and take you off to the asylum. You know, that's crazy talk. So, you know, Russia will, I think ultimately they'll sit down for surrender negotiations with somebody, whether it's General Sursky or whoever replaces him. Notice that the Russians announced today that the intelligence outfit in Kiev, Ukrainians, were the ones who were directly involved with the Crocus City Center attack. So they got clear evidence of that now. So Russia is going to make Ukraine pay for that. And Budanov he'll likely wind up on the gallows. I think the Russians may bring back the death penalty, especially for him.
Terry, how do you see the situation right now in Taiwan? We've seen that Chinese are getting more serious about the situation, and Taiwanese, they're responding to Chinese bringing out their weapons and to show Chinese. How's the situation there? Do you think Taiwanese are stupid enough to keep fighting China? Because that doesn't make sense.
I don't see China attacking Taiwan. I think this latest exercise, now understand, these military exercises, when they take place, it's not like the Chinese woke up last week and said, you know, we're really upset with those Taiwanese. Let's do a military exercise. Here, you do this and you do that, and we'll all meet on Monday and get started, okay? That's not how these come together. This started, was a pre-planned activity from, 12 to 18 months, maybe 24 months ago, 2 years. And they identified what the scenario was. They identified what units they wanted to be involved. They identified what their objectives were. And in this case, an objective, our first objective is to establish that we can provide a communications alert that will activate the forces, put them on alert, and then deploy them as required by the circumstance, number one. But then the second goal is to make sure that each of these units, once they're alerted to the need that a potential deployment, can effectively organize themselves and put their ships in conditions where that they can move from point A to point B. Third, to check out the ability to do command and control. Can you command under different circumstances or stressful circumstances to control the movement of the different units so that they work in concert? Those are the goals of an exercise like this. And that's exactly what China's doing. So this was pre-planned, but it was designed as well to send a very clear message to the Taiwanese and to the West, which is basically, don't screw around with us. We're dead serious. We hear you keep saying that you're going to go to war with us. So we're preparing to go to war with you. And in this case, what the Chinese will likely do, they'll just blockade the island. Taiwan needs stuff from outside. And that's why the blockade is one way you can bring them to their knees.
I think Putin, in his recent visit to China, just gave an okay to Xi to support them, whatever happens in Taiwan.
Yeah. Look, the Chinese are not crazy. I'm fascinated by all these Westerners. Oh, yeah, the Chinese are going to attack here and attack there. When have they done that? I mean, historically, the last time they carried out, we've talked about this before, and people get tired of me here saying it, but last time the Chinese used their military force outside of Chinese mainland was to attack the Vietnamese, because the Vietnamese were attacking the Cambodians, and the Vietnamese kicked the Chinese ass, period. So, the Chinese are a little hesitant to, get everybody all armed and juiced up to go do an amphibious invasion of Taiwan. Well, they don't need to do that. They'll be able to, through patience and an embargo, they can win over and take control of China or of Taiwan. So
when it comes to Ukraine, do you think Putin is preparing for a larger war, for a bigger war? And if NATO, nobody knows what NATO is going to do, but is he preparing for a bigger war, in your opinion?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why they built up the army to 1.3 million men right now. You know, at the start, at the, I think at the start of this, their total active duty was maybe 700,000. Still sizable, but not enormous. So they basically doubled the size of the army in the last 2 years. And their reserves are upwards of 2 million. So what we're talking about is they filled an army of 3.3, 3.5 million guys. The United States has got 452,000 plus another 700,000 in reserve. Okay, great. We got 1.1 million. Not enough. And so Russia is prepared to fight NATO. NATO is not prepared to fight Russia. Russia is not looking to fight NATO, but you got a lot of politicians in NATO that are mouthing off like, yeah, we want to fight Russia just as long as it's somebody else's kid, not mine. You know, that's what we're looking at.
Shifting the gear to the conflict in Gaza, and we've seen that Ireland, Norway, and Spain, just they're going to recognize the state of Palestine. And at the same time, ICC, International Criminal Court, just issued a warrant on Netanyahu. They're just talking about, it is urging the Netanyahu administration to stop attacking Rafah. How do you see the current situation right now?
Well, Israel's losing on all fronts with respect to these different judicial bodies. So the let's start with the ICC case. The problem with the ICC, and the prosecutor admitted it, he received a direct warning. He's a British citizen, and I suspect it was either Rishi Sunak or Boris Johnson, one of those, told him directly that, hey, the ICC is only for going after these African countries. Basically, we're just going to go after the blacks, the minorities. Stay away from the white people. Yeah, that's pretty racist. So the ICC, though, when it issued its arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, tried to balance it out, say, see, we're fair. We're going to go after Hamas leadership, too. And, you know, I'd be happy to argue the numbers with anybody, any day, anytime, anywhere. Hamas is not a massive, threatening terrorist organization. The numbers simply don't support that conclusion. 594 attacks attributed to Palestinians against Israelis from 2000 to April of 2024. And of those 594 attacks, they ultimately caused 1,455 deaths among the Israelis. And of all those attacks, you have only 105 attributed to Hamas. So a fraction of the total. So, but here's the ICC. You resolve, we're charging Hamas, where Hamas, really, in my view, they carried out an act of self-defense against an occupier. It was no different than the Patriots at Concord and Lexington shooting the Brits that were trying to seize Patriot arms and ammunition of the colonial Americans at that time. The ICC is more interesting because, they threatened to, the Germany said, oh, yeah, if Netanyahu sets foot here, we'll arrest him. Well, he's not going to go to Germany. You know, that's not going to happen. ICJ, though, is much more interesting. They issued a demand on Israel today to cease, desist, stop the invasion, open the crossings, stop killing these women and children. Remains to be seen if Israel does it or does not. This issue now will go before the Security Council, where I think it's pretty certain the United States will veto it. That'd be real interesting if the U.S. decides not to veto. Then Israel really will be under pressure. They'll say, okay, we can no longer necessarily count on the United States all the way. If it goes to the UN Security Council, UN U.S. vetoes it. But then comes the real Interesting twist. It was the UN General Assembly in 1947 that approved Israel as a new nation, as a new country. That same General Assembly can rescind Israel's membership in the UN for its failure to abide by decisions taken by either the Security Council or the General Assembly. So what we could be seeing here in the next few months is Israel getting booted out of the UN, which then I think would lead to pressure in the United States for the United States to withdraw from the UN, which I think candidly, a lot of people would be happy to see the United, okay, good riddance. Except that leaves the question, what happens into the whole UN complex there on the upper east side of Manhattan? You know, another issue. So all of these legal potential, these potential legal dangers to Netanyahu are cropping up at the same time that the war is not going well in Rafah or in the northern Gaza. You know, Rafah's in southern Gaza. Yet they continue to kill women and children and some men.
Yeah. Larry, how do you see this new recognition on the part of three European countries? How does that affect, how does that put a pressure on Netanyahu and his administration? He said that he's rejecting this recognition. But at the end of the day, is it going to put some sort of pressure on him?
So it could lead to the break in relationships with those three countries. And Colombia has already broken relations with Israel. I think Brazil has recalled its ambassador. So all Israel's doing is becoming more isolated. You know, Ringo Starr had it right. I get by with a little help from my friends. You got to have some friends. And all Israel is doing is seeing how many people it can piss off. You know, how many friends it can lose. So it's also, I think, important that Norway, Spain, and Ireland, Ireland's not part of NATO, but Norway and Spain are. And this represents a break with NATO. So you're already starting to see NATO fragment over both the war in Gaza and the war in Ukraine, because you've now got Hungary saying, wait a second, we're not down with sending more aid to Ukraine. No, count us out. So you got that split developing, likely to be supported by Slovakia. Then with Norway and Spain saying, you know, breaking with the United States and United Kingdom on that issue, that's going to release some tensions. So this is, you know, none of this helps Israel build support and have greater political support in the world. Just the contrary. It's leaving Israel more isolated with each passing day.
There is a report by Politico. It says 30 to 35% of Hamas forces have been killed by Israelis, and 65% of tunnels are intact. And it seems that Hamas has recruited thousands of new forces.
Yeah.
And when you put all these together, do you think that what would be the picture of Hamas today?
Well, I don't really think it's accurate to talk about Hamas military force. They are a guerrilla insurgent unit right now. Now, the attack they carried out on October 7th was an organized raid. That was fairly sophisticated. But I'm certain that some, if not many, of the people who participated in that may be dead now as a result of the Israeli attacks. But it misses the point that Hamas is principally a political movement. It's a movement based on Islamic principles, but ultimately committed to the liberation of Palestine and the establishment of a Palestinian state, without regard to whether they're Muslim, Christian, or Jew. They just want it to be under the principles of Islam as Hamas interprets it, but it's not to be an Islamic state in the same way that Iran is. Well, you know, right now, this bombing has created more support for Hamas. Just like we talked about, that when the United States firebombed Tokyo, it built support for the emperor. When the United States and Germany and then Britain bombed Dresden, built support for Hitler. When the Germans bombed England, it built support for Churchill. Duh. Guess what? When you're bombing and inflicting this kind of suffering on civilians, they blame the guys that bomb them. They don't blame the guys who are running the government. Just the opposite.
Do you see any sort of fracture in the support of Biden to Netanyahu and Israel?
Oh, yeah. Well, the fissures are developing. You know, I just saw Bernie Sanders speak yesterday, where I guess Chuck Schumer has invited Bibi Netanyahu to address the Congress, Schumer and Michael Johnson together. So Netanyahu is going to come do it. And, you know, Sanders was asked, are you going? He goes, hell no, I'm not going. The guy's basically a murderer. I'm not going to go sit and applaud a murderer. And there'll be a number of people, a number of Democrats, you know, was it Lisa Presley and AOC and others are, you know, they're just not going to have anything to do with it.
The squad.
Yeah, the squad.
Larry, just to wrap up this session, do you think that the Israeli lobby is still behind Netanyahu and his administration?
Well, there's still very much lobbying for the Zionist cause. And, you know, they divorced that from Netanyahu. But what's interesting is they tried to AIPAC, the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, tried desperately to take out Thomas Massie, a Republican congressman from Kentucky. And boy, he beat the hell out of two opponents in a primary. So it just showed that, hey, all that Israeli money didn't turn the table. Now the Israelis, this Israeli lobby is saying, oh, well, we just wanted to, you know, soften him up because we think he may run to replace Mitch McConnell. And Massie replacing Mitch McConnell would be great. Massey's one of the few really principled Republicans who's not out supporting all these wars, particularly in, you know, helping the Israelis beat the hell and murder the Palestinians. Man, Massie just laughed at it. He said, great. Thank you, AIPAC. You've now helped raise my profile around the state. More people now know who I am than before. Yeah, it is sort of counterintuitive, but that's how it works.